Oh, I'll bet that sounds familiar. Your neighborhood lawnmower symphony is back. The grass is growing fast again. It's green, it's lush, and yes, it's inviting. But what effect does that lawn have on our climate? This is NPR News, and I'm Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. Let's crank up the climate cast.
We have talked about it endlessly over the last decade or so, and we've accomplished close to zip.
We know enough about our climate problem to know that it's serious and that we need to get started right away.
In Kansas, it was 118 degrees. Now, you leave a candle on your porch in that kind of temperature, and it melts like a stick of butter.
What we're seeing right now is a clear loading of the weather dice.
Okay, full disclosure, I love a good lawn, but I've also lived in Arizona for 9 years in a beautifully xeriscaped yard with beautiful flowering plants, attractive landscape rocks, and very low water use, and hey, no mowing there. So I got to thinking about lawns and climate change. What's the impact of 40 million acres of lawn in the U.S. on CO2 emissions? And why are we so obsessed with our green lawns? Are there better alternatives to this suburban monoculture? And what about you? Would you consider making changes if it saved you water and helped our climate and our water quality? I want to hear from you about this today, so get in line here. Pick up the phone. Call me at 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828 and weigh in on lawns. My guest today on ClimateCast knows all about lawns and the urban landscape. Joan Nassauer is a professor of landscape architecture with the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Joan, welcome to ClimateCast.
Nice to be here.
Okay, 40 million acres, that's a lot of lawn in the USA. To misquote David Byrne of Talking Heads fame badly, how did we get here?
Well, you know, this is deep in the DNA of our democratic outlook on land in this country. Essentially, some of the early influencers of the way we design cities in this country were paying attention to what was going on in 18th century England. Mm-hmm. And there, the idea had taken root that a combination of open areas, think of that as lawn,
sure,
with big trees created a beautiful place. They called that the picturesque. Enter to England in the 18th century, the father of landscape architecture in this country, Frederick Law Olmsted, and he saw a good idea, but he added something to it. He said, we can make this more democratic by making sure that every residence has its own open space by which the house can be seen and the property can be shared by those who pass by, because it all can be seen over this beautiful lawn.
Well, that sounds great. I mean, that's idyllic, right? That sounds like, and I think this is true, that, you know, lawns are beautiful to many of us. You might even call it part of the American dream. But obviously, some are concerned that dream comes with a cost. And we know, for example, that running a lawnmower for an hour can emit as much CO2 as a 100-mile car trip. So lawns aside and the beauty aside, and I love my lawn too, what are some environmental impacts of lawns?
Well, we know that the degree of perfection that we came to expect of turf and our lawns in the 20th century was really different from when this aesthetic and this way of maintaining urban landscapes arose more than 100 years before that in this country. And that degree of perfection relies on fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides, and very importantly, irrigation. All of those inputs have environmental effects, and then add to that the carbon emissions from the fossil fuel-based machines that we use to cut grass and blow leaves.
And make fertilizer,
that's right. So I guess, you know, if you go back to when we started adopting this democratic interpretation of turf in this country, and it is just so embedded in the way we enjoy our landscapes, what I would suggest is that we might want to learn from what our grandparents did and the way, or our great-grandparents did, and the way they maintained their lawns without these inputs.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we know the fertilizer, 90 million pounds in the U.S., 78 million pounds of pesticides. That has downstream impacts on rivers, lakes, even our groundwater. Those are effects that maybe we don't think about, right, as we're taking care of our lawns?
That's right. Those downstream effects as it relates to groundwater even affect public drinking water supplies. We know that the amount of fertilizer that's used in urban areas, and very much including ex-urban areas beyond our cities that have certain norms for treatment of groundwater and surface water runoff, beyond that, we know that nitrogen and phosphorus from metropolitan landscapes are entering our lakes, affecting our fisheries, and even affecting public drinking water supplies, what you can get when you turn on the tap.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the urban and suburban environment and water. I have a little story here that I want to share with you. I moved to a townhouse development 3 years ago. It's fairly small. It's about 24 units. But I noticed what seemed to be a significant overwatering of the lawn and landscape. The sprinklers would be going off all the time. I'm a meteorologist. I knew we were going to get, you know, a couple inches of rain tomorrow, and the sprinklers are going full blast. And folks were having trouble with basement flooding. So I kind of put two and two together. I volunteered to control our irrigation system for our association. Here's what happened. Our water usage went from 880,000 gallons the year before to 129,000 gallons after I took control, about an 80% reduction. We saved a lot of water. We cut our association's water bill. Less frequent mowing required. The grass was still green. Less basement flooding. No insurance claims. You know, is my experience unique here, or do most of us overwater our lawns?
I'm not sure if most overwater. I do know that a very good and widely cited study of American lawns demonstrated that lawns are the most irrigated crop in the United States. Compared with any other irrigated crop, we irrigate a larger area of lawn in this country than any other crop. So your story is great, Paul, because it suggests this idea that we just need to be more sparing in our inputs in order to have less deleterious environmental effects. So what you did is terrific, and I suspect there are a lot of opportunities to just be more discerning, more sparing in the amount of turf we have and in the inputs we use for turf.
Joan, let's hear from a caller. Tom in St. Paul is on the line this morning. Tom, good morning. What's your question or perspective on lawns?
Good morning. Well, I hate mowing lawns. And I use an electric mower, so I'm not putting pollution out. But my idea has... I'm new to Minnesota. I came from Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And my idea is to turn my front lawn into prairie.
Ah.
I have a friend out of Northfield who does prairie restoration.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talked to me about different heights of prairie grasses, different grasses I might use. One of the things people have told me is that I might get flack from my neighbors or the city.
Yes.
About that.
Tom, that's a great point, and I want to bring Joan in on that. Thank you so much for the call. Joan, first of all, alternatives to lawns, and second of all, what do you do when your neighbors complain or maybe the city has ordinances that don't allow that kind of thing?
So Tom has a good idea, and I think a useful way to think about this is not so much as alternatives to lawn, but as combinations of mown turf with other kinds of covers, including gardens that can be made of prairie grass, gardens that can be made of shade-loving ground covers, gardens that can be made of shrubs that stay low. All of these are really good ways to combine different types of covers with just enough turf. An approach that I developed actually back when I was on the faculty at the University of Minnesota many years ago and first first developed in tests in Minnesota and have subsequently tested in many different settings, is to have just enough of what I dub cues to care. Perhaps the easiest cue to care to achieve in your home landscape is just a little mowing.
Hmm.
In all of the tests that we've done, and we've done lots and lots of surveys on this, consistently, as long as you have at least half of your front lawn in mown turf,
mm-hmm.
you can nearly do whatever you want with the rest.
Interesting.
As long as there's a clear view to the front door,
mm-hmm.
and the windows are not covered at the front of your house. So that whatever else you want to do can be a prairie garden. That's an approach that I've used in my own home landscape, and I'm very happy with it. It can also be something that is, you know, entirely composed of shrubs that are for people who really don't want to pay attention to what's a weed in the prairie. Sometimes a shrub garden is really easier to maintain if you aren't a plant lover.
Mm-hmm.
But combination is the key.
Combination.
And having a little mown turf in very prominent locations.
You know, I'm curious about the concept of lawns as a status symbol, sort of the sociology of lawns. It seems like, you know, a lot of suburban areas, it's all lawn. Neighbors might complain. You know, is this sort of camouflaged, stealthy, natural landscape sort of equal acceptance in some of our suburban areas?
That's exactly the kind of context in which I've done research, testing what is acceptable to people who live in the suburbs. And it's from those surveys that I offer this idea that you can change half your front lawn.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure that where you introduce other cover shrubs or prairie plants or whether perennial flowers, that they aren't impinging on the sidewalk or impinging on the curb of the road. But there's lots of room for play and lots of room to build into your turf lawn more environmental benefits. Let me give you an easy example.
Sure. We got a little less than a minute left, so have
so
at it.
So we care a lot about preventing climate change or at least mitigating what we have. An easy example is to create a low area in your front lawn. It can be turf. Keep it far from your house. But just let it puddle up now and then after a rainstorm. That's going to enhance carbon storage right in the turf you have. Small things can make a big difference for environmental benefits.
You know, I read about an interesting growing trend in sort of upscale places like Westchester County, New York, where some well-heeled homeowners are now putting in meadows. Is that a trend you're seeing? Is maybe my meadow is better than your meadow, the sort of environmentally friendly wave of the future?
Possibly. A key thing is lot size. It's much easier to do this in a socially acceptable way on a large lot, at least a half an acre, and very much if you have a lot over an acre, lots of opportunities to do that. Also, it's much easier to accomplish that in a wealthy neighborhood. Why? Because people in a wealthy neighborhood are to some degree assumed to be taking good care of their property. But in a working class neighborhood with smaller lots, there's just less room for play in terms of making sure that everything is well cared for on a smaller property.
Interesting discussion, Joan. Very, very good perspective today. You know, who knows? We've got the phenomenon of the McMansion around here where they're working on their way into smaller lots. Maybe the McLawn or the McPrairie will be a wave of the future, too. Joan Nassauer with the University of Michigan. Great discussion today. Thanks so much.